There are so many things I'd love to say about Gretchen as a writer, colleague, a teacher, and a friend. I'll start by calling her the fairy godmother of story, a title that can only begin to sum up what she has meant to so many of us in this room, plus thousands of students who have moved through VCU and taken courses with her, and the readers who are savoring her first book of stories, The Stillness of the Picture. You already know that she has published fiction and other work in some of the nation's top venues, from Alaska Quarterly Review to North American Review, and that she received the F. Scott Fitzgerald Award for Short Fiction and the Yemisi Magazine Award for Exceptional Contributions. She's also one of the nation's two top scholars on writer and editor William Maxwell, and she has published scholarship on F. Scott Fitzgerald himself. What you may not know, though if you've met her, you actually do know it, is that Gretchen is one of the most generous people you will ever meet. She's generous with her time, her insight, her fictional characters. Whether she meets a person in real life or in fiction, she gets inside each one's heart and mind and illuminates the darkest corners. And even if the character is what we might call a villain, she offers an intuitive understanding of what drives that person to do what he or she does. It's a rare kind of compassion, a true empathy, one that makes the reader suffer and ultimately soar through that heady atmosphere of understanding that the very best fiction offers. Gretchen's fiction offers the reader, very simply, everything she has. We're discussing The Stillness of the Picture in the graduate workshop, and some of the students, both fiction writers and poets, have contributed their thoughts to this introduction. Her characters struggle with the burden of things inherited, and some of them navigate through the fallout of inheritance denied. She writes with grace about the hopes and expectations that bloom effortlessly in youth, the ones that, when left unfulfilled, leave us spiraling and cut to pieces in the throes of adulthood. I'd say she breaks our hearts and remakes them again, story by story, in a completely immersive experience. And how does she manage it? Ryan Bonner, a poet, observed this about her technique. Gretchen's prose has a musicality that demands to be read out loud, or at least demands that you listen to your inner reading voice. One aspect of that music that I find intoxicating is her use of repetition, often within a sentence. Gretchen connects repeating words and phrases to demonstrate through language how we attempt to know the world. So often our knowledge comes from finding connections and testing where they break down. And behind this desire to know how the world works is a hope that the why will reveal itself through the how. Furthermore, her use of repetition also speaks to how one object can be viewed from a multitude of perspectives, as if she recognizes that it's true, there is nothing new under the sun, but even the oldest things hold new ways of seeing which have yet to be uncovered. And uncovering them is part of her mission. Gretchen is also the best reader I know. Students rightly brag about having gone through a course in literature or creative writing with her. She is attentive and thorough and in tune with both what the writer wants to do and what the reader will experience. I've experienced her attentiveness myself. We've been exchanging manuscripts for years. When my last novel was nearly done, she helped me diagnose an undefined problem nagging at me. She said, "I'm going to go outside for 10 minutes, and when I come back in, we're going to talk this out." The conversation that followed was great therapy, and it was also great writing advice. I will forever thank her as the godmother of the Kingdom of Little Wounds. She's a wonderfully honest person and a brilliant and engaging woman who I'm proud to call a mentor, but more thrilled to call a friend. And I'll quote Gretchen herself in an interview for Broad Street Magazine, in which she gave advice to those who are finding their way through the perilous terrain of imaginative writing. Here's her ultimate blessing to her readers, her colleagues, and her students. And so I say, in the hope that my doing so will make the process a little less disheartening for beginning writers, keep going. For if you keep going, the real or true story will reveal itself. And when that moment happens, the feeling is like no other. Gretchen, thank you for giving us a feeling like no other, and thank you for your stories and your friendship, and we look forward to hearing you read.
First off, I would like to thank Amanda for reading the introduction. Thank you very much, and thank you for your kind words about my stories as well as about me. And I'd like to thank Suzanne, who was not able to read tonight. I'm also grateful to the MFA faculty, Tom DeHaven, who's not with us tonight, Kathy Graber either, but David, Greg, Clint, Suzanne, Hannah, Sonia, and of course, Tom Dodato, who I don't see, and to David Latney for inviting me to be part of this reading series. And finally, I'd like to thank all of you all for coming. I see students in my 353 here. Hi. And Billy, my neighbor. So rather than read from my collection, which, as I was saying to Michelle and Greg earlier, I think I would vomit if I had to read from it. I'd like to read from a new series of stories I'm working on. I don't know if anybody else feels that way about published work, but once it's out there in the world, I never want to see it again. I feel like a different person and a different writer now who doesn't have anything to do with those stories. So I'd like to read from a new series of stories I'm working on. The stories are set primarily in a white middle-class suburb outside D.C. in the 1970s and 80s. And they center on the Marin family, Art, Dolores, and Rachel. But not all of the stories are told from the perspective of someone in the Marin family. And the one that I'm going to read from tonight is not told from Art or Dolores or Rachel's perspective. The story is called Baby Elephant Walk, and it's told from the point of view of a junior high school band teacher. He's also kind of a pedophile or would-be pedophile, but I still think he's a sympathetic character. I know that's hard to imagine, but I also think the story is kind of funny. The phallic imagery, you guys, is pretty over the top and pretty consciously so. So you all can tell me later if he's a sympathetic character or if the story is indeed funny, but it kind of amuses me. The story is called Baby Elephant Walk. When Mr. K walks into his classroom, the first person he sees is Stephanie Monahy. She is sitting on the back ledge next to Rachel Marin, window cranked open behind her, smoking a cigarette that, when Mr. K clears his throat, she discreetly drops outside the window into the courtyard. Despite the fact that smoke is rising into the room, Mr. K ignores the cigarette, for he has a soft spot for Stephanie. She is not one of the popular girls at Frederick Sasser Junior High, at least not popular like Julie and Robin and Stacy and Dana, who travel in a pack, the collars of their polo shirts standing stiff against their necks. Not like Claire Ashworth, who, he must admit, even though he doesn't want to because she lives in a sprawling country house that actually has a name, can belt out a tune when she performs in the musicals that the drama club puts on in the spring. No, Stephanie is popular in a different way, a way that Mr. K intuits in her bleached hair, her dark eyeliner, her too tight jeans. Mr. K sometimes sees her walking with her boyfriend as he drives through the neighborhood, Chris Folk's hands in the back pocket of those too tight jeans. Why Stephanie is sitting with Rachel Marin, a seventh grader, Mr. K doesn't know, for Rachel is a mousy girl, pretty, but mousy and painfully shy. Mr. K understands the shyness. He just spent his lunch break with Dolores Marin in the teacher's lounge, listening to her talk about how she wants to join the band. The marching band, he had said over his egg salad sandwich. Well, no, not the marching band, Mrs. Marin had said. Oh, you mean the orchestra, Mr. K said, thinking how his wife hadn't put enough mayonnaise in the egg salad. I don't quite know, Mrs. Marin said. I play guitar and sing. What kind of band do you have for that? Mr. K had explained to her that there was marching band and there was orchestra, and that neither one called for a guitar player or a singer. You might try the community advocate, he said, looking at his sandwich to keep out from blurting out the absurdity of her desire to play music with junior high school students. Sometimes people place ads in there, you know, community members, adults, looking to form a local band. Mrs. Marin had looked at him queerly, and that's when he noticed the tiny tubes at the inner corners of her eyes. Behind him in the courtyard, the maintenance men were cutting the grass, for it was May, a month ago before school let out for the summer. With his sandwich still in his hand, Mr. K stood up and cranked the window closed, and when he turned her back around, Mrs. Marin had risen from her seat to go. Thank you, she said. Thank you very much. No problem, Mr. K had said, glancing at the clock on the wall. No time left to finish his lunch. Still hungry, he threw the sandwich in the waste paper basket and then gathered up the pages of sheet music spread out over the desk, leaving the lounge for his classroom down the hall where he finds Stephanie Monahy sitting with Rachel Marin on the ledge. The other kids mill around the classroom, taking instruments from their cases. Mr. K looks at Stephanie, whose eyes are hidden behind sunglasses with mirrored lenses. Her hair was brown last year, but this year it is a strawberry shade of blonde, the feathers perfectly in place. Mr. K imagines her in front of a bathroom mirror, curling those feathers with the wand of a curling iron. His wife used to curl her hair in the mornings before she decided that doing her hair took away too much time from her clarinet, and so cut it short, short as one of the boys in Mr. K's orchestra. Stephanie's hair is long, the feathers falling well below her shoulders, scraping the tops of her breasts. She is smiling now, lips covered in cheap pink gloss that Mr. K imagines, if he were to get close enough, would smell like watermelon or bubblegum or sour grape. Standing in the classroom, he continues looking at Stephanie, and for all he knows, Stephanie may be returning his gaze, those damn sunglasses, until his concentration is interrupted by a muffled sound coming from the instrument closet. "Can anyone tell me what that noise is?" Mr. K says. "Oh, that's just Matt Sheridan," says Stephanie. "We locked him in the closet." "Why?" says Mr. K. "Because Rachel likes him," says Stephanie, shoving Rachel in the shoulder. "But she's too afraid, you see, to go in there and do anything about it." Mr. K walks to the closet, pulls his keys from his jacket pocket, and unlocks the door. Matt Sheridan emerges, red-faced, his straight brown hair stuck to his forehead with sweat. "What the hell?" Matt says, and Mr. K tells him not to swear. Matt shuffles back to his seat in the horn section, picks up his cornet, and blows a sound uglier than any curse word that Mr. K can think of. "That's enough," Mr. K says. "Everyone take their seats. Remember that the spring concert is at the end of the week." Chairs scrape the floor and instruments clang against the metal seats. Stephanie hops down from the ledge, and Mr. K watches as she makes her way to the front of the room, where she presents to him the spare key to the instrument closet that he keeps in the drawer of his desk. Later that day, Mr. K is driving home when he spots Stephanie with Chris Vokes walking down Old Colony. As usual, Chris's hand is in the back pocket of Stephanie's jeans, and Stephanie puffs a cigarette, blowing out the smoke in a long practice stream. Mr. K slows down as he approaches them, downshifting in his pacer so abruptly that the folds of sheet music in the hatchback pitch forward towards the back seat. As he slows, he rolls down his window, his eyes all the time on Chris's hand in the back pocket of Stephanie's jeans. Last fall, and to his horror, Mr. K found himself watching Stephanie's ass swing from side to side during marching band practice. He was to the left of the marching line, baton aloft, between the flutes and the clarinets, Stephanie is a flute, and there it was, in the third flute position, tight and round in Jordache jeans. The leaves had gathered at the edges of the back parking lot where some of the ninth graders, the older ones who should already be at the high school, parked their cars which the marching band had to walk around because the football team had the field. Once, on a windy afternoon, Mr. K thought that he caught a glimpse of Stephanie in the back seat of Volks' Hornet. When he questioned her about her absence from practice the next day, she had assured him that she was okay, not really sick or anything, just some kind of stomach bug. She had removed her sunglasses to speak to him, and he couldn't help but notice the heavy mascara on her lashes, the purple shadow on her lids. Because she had kept on her sunglasses today, Mr. K couldn't see her eyes, and as the pacer pulls up behind Stephanie and Chris, he wonders what the color is on her lids. When he is idling beside them, he leans his head out of his window, how he wishes he were holding a cigarette, how he wishes he still smoked, and asks them if they need a ride. "Mr. K," says Stephanie, "you snuck up on us." "Did I?" says Mr. K. "I didn't mean to." "Do you live around here?" Stephanie says. "Just down the road over on Bayberry." "We're heading to the park," says Stephanie. "Yeah," says Chris, "to the park." He and Stephanie erupt into giggles. "All righty then," says Mr. K. And then, because he doesn't know what else to say, "I guess you two don't need a ride." He presses his foot on the accelerator, wishing he had a car with power, a Mustang maybe, or a Trans Am, so that he could burn rubber, leave them and their giggling behind in a thick cloud of exhaust. As it is, he putters down the street, and when he glances in his rearview mirror, the two of them are standing still on the side of the road, Volks' tongue clearly down Stephanie's throat. Disgusting, Mr. K thinks, although he can see Stephanie's attraction to Chris. He is lanky and tan, with black hair that fringes his eyes, the kind of boy that Mr. K had wanted to be when he was in junior high school even. Instead, he was pudgy, pale, and broad-faced, although in a college, a late growth spurt had redistributed his weight. Still, he is a big man, and he knows that he had missed out on something that he can't quite name, but that he thinks has to do with confidence, and confidence owned at an early age. Mr. K turns left onto Green Heaven and then right onto Bayberry. Mara's car is parked in the driveway, which means she is home from class. His wife teaches over at the community college and has played clarinet in the county orchestra for almost a decade. In fact, they met at a woodwinds audition for the orchestra, but while Mara had won second chair, Mr. K had only been chosen as an alternate. For a few years, he had attended the rehearsals, but partly because he was never asked to sit in during a performance, and partly because he was tired of his days spent listening to adolescents squawk or squeal or squeak on their instruments, he had finally given up his seat. He pulls in behind Mara's old diesel wagon, which she has driven for as long as he has known her, and shoves the gear shift into first, and then pulls the emergency brake. He knows he will have to move his car later, for today is Wednesday, and so Mara has rehearsal tonight. He will also have to get his own dinner, and as he gets out of the car, he sighs. The cherry tree in the corner of the front yard is losing its blossoms, and pink flowers are scattered across Mara's windshield. With his forearm, he wipes them away, and they fall to his feet. Mr. K kicks at them, and then makes his way up the concrete steps to the front door. Once inside, he calls out to Mara, telling her he is home, and then climbs the stairs into the living room. Sitting in the chair, he slips off his shoes, and when his socks are neatly tucked into his loafers, he stands and walks into the kitchen, where he opens the door to the refrigerator. It's too early for a beer, and so he pulls out the carton of milk instead. Opening the cardboard wings, he takes a swig and then returns the carton to the fridge. The post is still on the kitchen table, and he sits down to read it. On a whim, he skims the classifieds under the Musicians Wanted heading. He discovers that a salsa band is looking for a percussionist, and a polka band is looking for an accordion player. He closes the paper and looks through the window into the backyard, where a dogwood stands beside the fence. Behind the fence rise the power lines up on the hill that he knows the neighborhood kids slid down every time it snows. He wonders if this is the park to which Stephanie and Chris were going, but it isn't a park, really, just a slope. And if he were to open the back gate, if anyone on Bayberry were to open his back gate, he would have the whole view of the slope before him. Mr. K knows that kids from the high school sometimes hang out there at night under the impression that the darkness obscures them from sight, for he has seen the orange dots of their cigarettes bob from his bedroom window, heard their shouts and the hollow clanking of their beer cans. Still, he doubts that Stephanie and Chris were headed there. More likely, they were headed to Brandywine Park, across from the high school on Croom Road. Mr. K knows that there is a back way, a path that leads to the park from the neighborhood through the woods, but he doesn't know where the entrance is. For a moment, he thinks about getting in his car again, seeing if Stephanie and Chris are still further up the road, and following them to the entrance to the path. But he doesn't know what such an action would accomplish, and, in any case, they would recognize his car. Mr. K feels a pang of hunger and remembers that he never finished his lunch. He gets up and opens the cabinet, takes out a box of crackers, and opens the cellophane sleeve. He has eaten crackers over the sink when Mara walks into the kitchen, and for a moment Mr. K is startled, for he still hasn't gotten used to her cropped hair. "Hungry," says Mara. "Starved," says Mr. K. "I didn't get to finish my lunch." "What was the problem today?" asks Mara, fishing in her handbag for her keys. "Fire drill, or were you on cafeteria duty?" "Neither," says Mr. K. "A woman came to see me about joining the band." "What woman?" says Mara. "And what band?" "One of the mothers," says Mr. K, folding the cellophane package closed and putting the crackers away. "She thought she could play with the kids." "A kook," says Mara, who has found her keys. "I need to get going. We're on Stravinsky now, and I'm a little rusty, so I want to get some practice hours in before rehearsal." "What time will you be home?" says Mr. K. "Usual," Mara says, which means Mr. K will already be in bed. "I have to move the car," says Mr. K, "unless you want to take mine." "I'll move it," Mara says. "Keys?" Mr. K retrieves his keys from his jacket pocket and hands them to his wife. When she is gone, he moves into the living room, watches as she backs the Pacer out of the drive and onto the street where she parks it in front of the house. And then he meets her at the door, where she hands him his keys and then gives him a quick kiss on the cheek. With the door closed, he hears the diesel engine roar to life. The sun is still bright, still streaming in through the glass panels on either side of the door, through the living room window, and yet Mr. K flips the switch on the wall so that the light comes on above him in the foyer. Mr. K wakes up in the early morning, his wife in bed beside him, but he clings to sleep like he clings to the blankets, waiting to see what Stephanie will say. In the dream, they're in the kitchen, bathed in pale green light, and when Stephanie reaches out her hand to touch him, he thinks, he tells her to remember that he is a man. But Stephanie doesn't touch him. Instead, she shakes a cigarette from a pack on the table, a pack that Mr. K knows is his. The cigarettes are his brand, Marlboro Reds, and he knows that Stephanie smokes Virginia Slims, for he has looked out the window in his classroom to see the pink-rimmed butts lying in the grass of the courtyard. This small act of taking one of his cigarettes from his pack without asking endears Stephanie to him all the more. And as he sits in that unfamiliar kitchen in that unfamiliar light, he knows that Stephanie is about to say something, but he doesn't know what it is. Mr. K keeps his eyes closed, waiting, but it is no use. He is awake, the dream is over, and he feels a melancholy is hard put to explain. The curtains drawn over the window glow an even shade of gray, and he knows that morning is on the way, and so he reaches over and pushes the button on the alarm clock so that it doesn't ring. He gets up from the bed, stretches, and, on impulse, pulls the covers up over Mara's shoulders. He heads for the bathroom, turns the knob in the shower in order to give the water time to heat, and then checks his face in the mirror, runs the electric razor on his neck below his beard. Standing in the shower, he thinks back to the dream, wonders what he meant when he told Stephanie that he was a man, and then wonders again what it was that she was going to say. Mr. K stops by the 7-Eleven on his way into school and buys a pack of cigarettes, which he tucks into his shirt pocket as he pulls his car into a space in the back lot. He parks next to Volks' Hornet, surprised at Volks is in so early, but then he remembers that the kid is in Mr. Salerno's special education class and that Salerno requires all his kids to be in by 7:30. The special ed class is the last stop before the students are transferred to Krumvo Tech, a group of squat concrete buildings down the road from the high school that until 20 years ago had served as a missile silo designed to counteract the Russians in an attack on Washington, D.C. Mr. K has been there. One summer, when he was too low on the totem pole to garner summer classes, he had taken the only job the county could offer him, one in which he was supposed to teach music appreciation to disadvantaged youths. It wasn't so much of a class as it was a camp, kids from all over the county arriving at Krumvo Tech with their bedrolls and worn-out sleeping bags to bunk in the outbuildings. The camp lasted all of July, but by the time the second week had arrived, Mr. K had given up playing cassette recordings of Beethoven and Mozart in the stuffy, stale-smelling classrooms, and had instead set the cassette player up before the public address system in the main office, blasting the music over tinny speakers to the tiny recreational pool outside. As the kids splashed in the water, Mr. K would mill about the office, glancing out the window every now and again to make sure everyone was still alive, sometimes studying the class pictures that hung from the wall. The classes were small. The class of 73 was made up of 29 students, while the class of 75 topped out at 25, and in all the pictures, the boys had long, mangy hair and a vacant look in their eyes. The girls, too, although there were fewer of them, had long hair, straight and parted down the middle mostly, although one girl, class of 78, had feathers like the ones that framed Stephanie's face. As Mr. K closes the door of his car, he glances inside the passenger window of the Hornet. There on the front seat is a textbook for basic arithmetic. Mr. K shakes his head, for although he has never had Volks in a class, he knows that the administrators got it wrong. Volks is not a slow kid, he thinks, for he doesn't have that vacant look in his eyes. Andy is with Stephanie Monahy, who Mr. K knows is bright. When she turned up in his classroom at the start of her seventh grade year, he had listened to her play, and she was quite good. Could have even, if she had worked hard enough, beat out Lisa Wilson for second chair when auditions were held at the end of the quarter. But she hadn't worked hard enough and had not earned second chair, and Mr. K had looked up her transcripts, found that in all of her other classes she had earned A's. Walking through the back lot, Mr. K notices that all the old leaves gathered at the edges have been raked away. The trees are green and leafy, and above him the sky is a brilliant shade of blue. Mr. K whistles while he walks, tapping the heel of his hand against his leg. He whistles the tune the kids are working on for the spring concert, Baby Elephant Walk. It is a song he knows well, a standard for junior high and high school orchestras. He remembers playing it himself back in high school, just a few years before those kids in the class of 73 stared into the camera in the multipurpose room at Krumvo Tech. He had held first chair and dreamed of the day when high school ended, when he would leave the grounds of the high school that were not so very different from the grounds of the junior high through which he now walks, for college, and then for New York and the Philharmonic. He had won a scholarship to Maryland, where he had sat fifth chair, but his musical career ended there, for in 4 years he had never risen above fifth chair. And so he had begun taking classes in the School of Education, had graduated 1 year late with a dual degree, music performance and music education. He applied for teaching jobs in all the counties in the state, and by the end of the summer, he had landed the job at Frederick Sasser in PG. As Mr. K walks through the glass doors of the school, he feels good, for it is a beautiful day in spring, and as he walks down the empty hallway to his classroom, he is enveloped in the lovely haze of his dream, rendered more real by the pack of cigarettes in his shirt pocket. Inside his classroom, he walks over to the ledge at the back of the room. He cranks one window after another open until all of the windows are open and a breeze moves through the room. And then he sits on the ledge, approximating the space that Stephanie occupied yesterday, and takes the pack of cigarettes from his shirt pocket. He pulls the string of cellophane, flips the lid on the top of the box. When he smoked, he always bought hard pack, never soft, and tears out the foil. He puts the cigarette in his mouth and lights it with a match from the pack the clerk at the 7-Eleven had slid across the counter. He breathes in the smoke, coughs a little but holds it in, and then blows it out in a long stream. The pleasure is enormous, not only the taste of the tobacco and the buzz of the nicotine, but the thrill of doing something that he shouldn't do, for woodwind players shouldn't smoke. And yet he had smoked all through high school and college, for he thought that smoking would give him that something that was always missing, that something that he sees in Volks, and that he wants Stephanie to see in him. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Gretchen. That was terrific. I should mention that books by our evening's readers are available as you exit. You can't miss them as you leave. So please purchase one. The authors will sign them. And I'm David Wojahn from the Creative Writing Faculty, and this is the last of our readings for the 16-17 Visiting Writers series. And we will begin again next year, next fall, with the Larry Levis Reading Prize and with the First Novelist Award readings. Both of them will take place in the fall. And I just wanted to thank some of the people who helped the series to work this year: the English Department, the Creative Writing Faculty, College of Humanities and Sciences, and John Olmschneider, our intrepid university librarian, and above all, Tom Dodato, who does everything. So it's a pleasure to introduce Karen Soley to you tonight, who's come to Richmond from her home base in Toronto. Over the course of 5 collections of verse, she's developed one of the most distinctive poetic voices at work today. When I read one of her poems, I feel as though I'm watching a road movie, an oddball and haunted one, maybe in the style of Werner Herzog or Wim Wenders. Soley is at the wheel of a huge gas guzzler, maybe an Impala or a Lincoln. She's driving through the flatness and little towns of the Canadian West. The radio's on scan, and in the back seat, she has as passengers John Ashbery, Thomas Tranströmer, Richard Hugo, and Wisława Szymborska. They're arguing among themselves, they're cacophonously shouting directions at her, and Soley is completely nonplussed about it all. She knows how to wrangle her passengers, to stop them from bickering, treating these august riders like kids on a long car ride, distracting them by saying things like, "Look at that big box store, that strip mall, that decrepit downtown, that forlorn roadside attraction." I offer this fantasy as an inadequate way to tell you what Karen Soley is all about. Her writing represents everything that's best in contemporary poetry, and she combines those characteristics in ways that have great panache and are always unpredictable and surprising. You can get a flavor of this in her titles. Among my favorites are "Your Premiums Will Never Increase," "Self-Portrait as a Series of Professional Evaluations," "Roof Repair and Squirrel Control," and "When asked why he was talking to himself, Pyro replied he was practicing to be a nice fellow." The poems are philosophical and whimsical by turns. They celebrate contemporary culture while at the same time sternly critiquing it. They know that poets must be responsible for both private self-reckonings and for performing a kind of civic duty. And they know how to begin in dyspepsia, but end with a sly epiphany. All this makes for a remarkable body of work. Karen Soley was born in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, and her books include Pigeon, Modern and Normal, The Road In Is Not the Same Road Out, and The Living Option, a volume of new and selected poems. She's won a number of awards and honors, including the Griffin Poetry Prize, Trillium Book Award, and last year the Canada Council for the Arts Victor Martin Lynch Stanton Award for Outstanding Achievement by a Canadian Artist. Please welcome Karen Soley.
Oh, thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's a Crown Victoria, actually, my parents' Crown Victoria from the farm that I've driven. Although not with those wonderful people in the back, only in my head. But yes, they're all there. I'm so honored to have been asked to come here, and I'm so happy to be here. It's going to be a short trip, but it's a beautiful place, and thank you for having me. I'm just going to read a few poems from The Road In Is Not the Same Road Out. And I'm going to start with the second last poem in the book, but I feel like sometimes it takes a while to figure out what's really going on in the writing of a particular group of poems. And so the poems at the end seem to sort of cast light for me on what I was after all along. So this is called Man is a Rational Animal. It was the same life, more or less. Yet suddenly, a flight itinerary represented the most tangible indication of my fate. From the air, I saw mountains, forest, lakes in which dissolved the notion of ownership, and the sweet little beach craft wagged its tail on landing in a crosswind. My fellow passengers claimed their long guns, carried them in cases like guitars out of the terminal. Darkness accompanied the second segment. The Dash 8 traversing the southwest in high cloud and swinging out over the Atlantic. Lights might have been ships or islands, towns someone from there could identify, but I wasn't from there. Where land ended and the water began was indiscernible, though I was not afraid, because I didn't know what I was seeing. Throughout the years, I've written a lot of airplane poems because I'm really afraid of flying. And I don't know, it seems to be something that stays with a person. It's so strange. It's a strange thing to do. I have lived in Toronto for a number of years now, and periodically, Toronto sees the rise of a little bed bug problem. And I mean, it's like they're always there, right? But once in a while, the media, it just really ramps up in the media, and everybody's freaked out about bed bugs, and me being one of them. It got a little out of hand there for a while. So this is called Be Reasonable. My husband says to set the legs of our bed in buckets of water is to overreact. He does not subscribe to the online bed bug registry, does not acknowledge on his tactical map the advance from the Delta, the Odeon, incubation in the warm folds of the greater film industry, in homeless shelter and the public upholsteries. A sideboard proclaiming itself free at the curbside is a Trojan horse. On our street, posts from 83, then 96, where it's reported the landlady presents with an aggressive strain of denial and poor interpersonal skills. Not my business? They make it my business. Often, I don't recognize what I'd rather not do until I've agreed to do it. Then I know what I want, and what I want makes me weak. I grew up comforted by coyotes in the evening, but the news from the suburbs is, be afraid. It seems you can live your whole life with a creature and only know it one way. The pine beetle and rusty grain beetle don't realize the harm they do. They are only having experiences. I didn't want to kill the house spiders, but they died in my engagement with the larger project. The spray bottle of dimethyl benzyl ammonium chloride is empty. Once I leave the room, the job will be finished. A few years ago, my husband and I went to a show at the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto that featured an exhibit of Mark Rothko paintings. And they had the Rothkos in their own room. And it's like you walk into this room and it's like, I want to camp in this room for the weekend. It was a beautiful, beautiful room. However, somewhat, you know, fraught feeling as Rothko can make you feel. And while we were there, we're looking at the paintings and there was an art camp that came in, like a group of kids, 9, 10 years old maybe, and they had a leader, a counselor with them, who told them, I want you to break off into groups of 2 or 3 and go and sit in front of the Rothkos and talk about how it makes you feel. And so, you know, these kids, they broke off and they sat cross-legged on the floor in front of the paintings. And so we're sitting there and the kids are looking at the paintings and there were three little girls beside us, and one of them said eventually, I feel sad. And there was a pause, and another one said, no, it's more like disappointment. Around the same time that we'd gone to this show, I'd been watching a documentary series called Middletown, which followed some of the inhabitants of Muncie, Indiana, in the 1980s. And it was an era that I identified with as my own high school years, and also the landscape. So there were familiar aspects to it, and the two experiences sort of converged. So this is called Rothko via Muncie, Indiana. And there are a couple of lines adapted in this poem from the Manifesto on Art that Adolf Gottlieb wrote with Rothko in the 30s. Rothko via Muncie, Indiana. The 1980s, beginning of the long decade, the century's late works. Snow on the grid, field bisected by a new model John Deere's Progress in low gear with a front end load of straw bales. Its operator's daughter dons her brace, thinks her scoliosis the devil's work on her, a not good enough Christian. Her mother talks scripture on the phone in the kitchen, and the kitchen smells of coffee and it smells of dog. Christmas lights strung along the eaves of bungalows, vehicles moored to bungalows by their block heater cords. Rumors of drunkenness and corruption sunk the Democrats' bid for mayor. For we favor the simple expression of the complex thought, the large shapes impact of the unequivocal, flat forms that destroy illusion and reveal truth. Now, the union's eye has twilight in it, and the city dump will stay where it is. Evening falls, or rises, or emanates from the figures. The Sportsplex and Model Aviation Museum, the Muncie Mall and both quadrangles of Ball State University shed their associations, perform an unknown adventure in unknown space. Halogens illuminate an anecdote of the spirit. You won't see his face around here again. The Violet Quarry hosts a greater darkness further in. The White River sleeps in its cabin of pack ice. Among the graduating class, an abstract feeling develops, an inclination to symbolism born of the fatal car wreck on New Year's, a spike in requests for Bob Seger to the call-ins from a quasi-religious experience of limitless immensity. To achieve this clarity is inevitably to be misunderstood. Their lives take on the dimensions of the fields, the city, its facades, and its plan, whose happiness will be their own. Rent, food budget, sweaters indoors. Basketball, basketball, and a second marriage. I'm going to read the title poem, which came about in part from a trip that we took to the Grand Canyon a while ago. I was listening to a CBC radio program about getting lost, and they referenced Rebecca Solnit's great book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, and examine the phenomenon of why it's possible to feel that you're lost when you're walking back along the same way you got to wherever you were going. And it's because we don't look behind us and things look different when we're going the other way. So the road in is not the same road out. The perspective is unfamiliar. We hadn't looked back driving in and lingered too long at the viewpoint. It was a prime of life experience. Many things we know by their effects. Void in the rock that the river may advance. Void in the river that the fish may advance. Helicopter in the canyon, like a fly in a jar, a mote in the eye, a wandering cause. It grew dark, a shift change and a shift in protocol. To the surface of the road, a trail rose, then a path to the surface of the trail. The desert sent its loose rock up to sea. An inaudible catastrophic orchestra is tuning. We feel it in the air, impelled before it as a pressure on the brain. In the day, separate rays fall so thickly from their source, we cannot perceive the gaps between them. But night is absolute, uniform, and self-derived, the formerly irrelevant brought to bear, the progress of its native creatures unimpeded. We have a plan between us, and then we each have our own. Land of the four corners, the silent partner, $500 down, no questions. The rental car stops at the highway intersection, a filthy, violent storm under the hood. It yields to traffic from both directions. It appears it could go either way. This is a poem called Spiral. I spent a lot of years working at three, it felt like a lot, working as a newspaper reporter in Lethbridge, Alberta. And I made a good friend there, who was a troubled friend, a good friend, whose name is Jimmy Coates, and it's to his memory that this poem is dedicated. I wrote the poem after a trip to the Isle of Skye in Scotland, and the only thing that Lethbridge, Alberta, and the Isle of Skye have in common is the wind. This is called Spiral. You said a storm makes a mansion of a poor man's house. I wonder if you did so to make the best of living where it always blew. The maddening wind that messed up our irons and made men want to fight. Now you have no house. There's no need. The cure took the good with the bad. Who cannot escape his prison but must each day rebuild it? For a year, rather than drink, we smoked and went to bingo. It was like working in a mine. The air quality and incessant coughing, bag lunches, good luck charms, the intergenerational drama. It's not my place to say what changed. You hadn't developed around a midpoint and fell to the side. A part remained exposed. Still, you were kind, unusually so, it seems to me now, for someone with talent. But loneliness expands to fill the void it creates. To plot against it was to plot against yourself. You felt the effect of the whole. When the mind is so altered, this resembles death, but it is not death. Then the faint trail ran out, and you continued on. The night you've entered now has no lost wife in it, no daughter, no friends, betrayal, or fear. It is impartial, without status. I would like to think it peace, but suspect it isn't anything. When our friend wrote you died, I was on sky, where the wind in its many directions is directionless and impossible to put your back to. He said you'd been living rough for a while. He wouldn't go to the wake at the bar. It was too much sadness. That day, I'd walk the beach, picking up shells. They're spirals of Archimedes and logarithmic spirals, principle of proportional similarity that protects the creature and makes it beautiful. Sandpipers materialized through tears the wind made, chasing fringes of the rising tide. At first, there were two, then three appeared. But when I began to pay attention, I realized they were everywhere. I'm going to end with the title poem of the collection published in the UK, the selected poems, The Living Option. And before I do, I want to thank Gretchen for that amazing reading. Thank you. It was wonderful. When I was writing this poem, I was rereading William James' The Will to Believe. And at the same time, they were firing up the Large Hadron Collider again, and which caused, I'm sure I'm not the only one who was wondering, you know, is this really a good idea, this thing? You know, so, but it's a very interesting philosophical endeavor as well as an endeavor of science and practicality eventually. So those two things kind of converged, and in thinking about belief and where one puts it, I'd also been interested for a while in negative theology and Gnostic texts. And there's a Gnostic text called the Second Treatise of the Great Seth from around the 3rd century. It's a fascinating piece of writing and variously interpreted, but at its core, it examines belief and the possibility that one is mistaken, one has been mistaken. So there's a little refrain that from that text that winds through it as well. So it's the living option. Having crawled from the desert of the 1970s, already graying a little, impatient, with physical inconsistencies, crying bosons and fermions, crying out the four forces, calling the unified from the unnamed wastes, it saw in our homes a vacancy, began repurposing the furniture. Already it seems never to have been otherwise. When I think of it, my atoms are as the weakening euro, the housing bubble, too many parts in search of the one part. It's a joke. It's a giant scientific instrument outside Geneva. An argument that knows not me or my siblings, that has no dominion over me, yet enters my thinking and undermines it. Then all of my theories seem raised by the state, fearful, acting out inappropriately. I went to see you on an airplane, and on an airplane was I medicated amid the transatlantic generation and its complimentary beverages. People of the light, flying over the living waters. My body, belted in, a joke, and the heap we call a mind also, each atom an engine schematic, a backup system sequence or a prayer from childhood, though I lost my faith. That's how weak I am. But in the cockpit, threefold, the great invisible virgin spirit was incorruptible in my sedation, and in the cabin, the new cashless society, and off the wings, degrees of freedom. No patterns emerged between us. It was new each time, each event its own, with fresh odds. We honored the principle, though our creditors didn't see it that way. They filled our past with their notices. Their notices were our bridesmaids. When I think of it, all my atoms are past due notices, but with the option to consolidate as one large debt. The market writes its autobiography on minds and bodies, my own and those of my siblings. Are we not innocent with respect to it? Our credit rating is a joke. Our homes venture with us through the rental agencies. We went west before the west dried up. Between Callaway Park and Dead Man's Flats, the cumulonimbus extended their funnels. Melancholy and inquisitive, they love the earth so much. Long-haul truckers, shepherds of product, blew past on deadline into the storm, tweaking in their cabs, each cloaked in his machine with a handgun for an angel in the lots and roadside pullouts. If you can't see it, it has the advantage. If you can't see it, it's philosophy, a game between us and the nature of things. People of intent in the valley of the shadow of. 100 meters underground, a divine heart races in the apparatus, and soon we will hear its voice. It will speak out from the invisible orders, not as an attribute, a quality or quantity, but a truth perfected in all the ineffable places. A live hypothesis, a supersymmetry. Is it possible to love something like this? I prayed it might happen to me. Thanks so much.